Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we are talking about a topic that personally fascinates me, winter in the Middle Ages.
The image most people have of this time is often quite one-sided. Eternal cold, darkness, suffering, that's how people imagine it.
But that wasn't exclusively the case. Sure, winter was harsh, no question. But people didn't just struggle through. They also created real moments of comfort and joy. That's easy to forget when you only think about the hardships.
Important point. And when we talk about medieval winter, we first need to clarify how cold was it actually? Because the climate was, well, it wasn't constant throughout this entire era. There were considerable fluctuations.
You mean the climate optimum?
The so-called medieval climate optimum, exactly. We're talking about a phase, roughly from the 10th to the 13th century, with comparatively mild temperatures. And now, hold on.
Tight. Wine cultivation in England.
You know the fact.
Of course. I still find that incredible. In England, they grew wine. And not just there. In more northern regions here too. Like along the Saale and Unstrut rivers, there was viticulture. Further north, it was rare, but still, regions we don't associate with wine culture at all today.
The climatic conditions actually made that possible. Functioning vineyards where today rain and cool summers dominate. Average temperatures were noticeably higher than in the following centuries.
For people back then, that must have seemed completely normal. They had no weather forecasts, no climate data, no long-term records. They only knew their own reality, their own frame of reference.
Right, and the generation before them, the stories of their...
grandparents. That was their frame of reference. That's all they had.
And then came the change. From the 14th century onwards, it became noticeably colder. The mild times were over. That must have been...
for the population, it must have been a shock. They couldn't explain at all.
For them, it was simply bad weather. Worse year after year. Harvests became unreliable, winters harder and longer. Without our modern understanding of climate cycles, they were relatively helpless against it.
And there was no central communication. They didn't know whether it was just as bad 200 kilometers away. Or better. Each region had to fend for itself.
The 1430s are considered a particularly extreme cold period, truly devastating for agriculture and the entire food supply. Entire harvests failed.
It must have varied a lot by region, right? Europe is huge.
Absolutely. In the Alps, it was already harsher anyway. They knew hard winters. But for people in previously milder regions who were suddenly confronted with this extreme cold, adapting was much...
harder. They had to completely change their entire way of life. Clothing, housing, how they stored provisions, everything had to be completely reconsidered.
And that's exactly what they did, with remarkable creativity and ingenuity. People in the Middle Ages weren't passive victims of circumstance. They actively developed solutions.
They found strategies not just to survive, but to lead a worthwhile existence during these cold months. That really deserves respect.
Which brings us directly to the question, how did they actually manage it? With clothing, with heating their spaces?
So much cleverness in that. So how did people actually keep warm? Let's start with clothing. The basic principle was simple, but effective. Layers. Multiple layers on top of each other, as needed.
The onion principle, basically.
And it still works today. Undershirt. Over that a doublet or tunic. then maybe a jacket, and on the outside a thick cloak, plus accessories, gloves, fur caps, multi-layered stockings, and then additional leg warmers, wrapped wool leg bindings, for example. Those were wound over the hose and provided extra warmth.
Practical. And the fur topic is interesting because many think fur was only for...
the nobility. But that's only partially true. Sure, the really fine stuff like ermine or sable, that was strictly regulated. Ermine, for example, was reserved for high nobility, that pure white with the black tail tips. But fur caps made of rabbit or sheepskin? Peasants and craftsmen wore those too.
There were even sumptuary laws that determined who could wear which fur. You could read someone's status directly from their fur.
Although even among poorer people, at least a narrow strip of fur on clothing was common. That wasn't luxury. That was necessity against the cold. And for the working population, something else came into play. Sturdy wool fabrics. Leather was mainly used for shoes, belts, gloves, or as protective aprons for certain trades, not for everyday jackets or trousers.
Functional clothing in the best sense had to withstand a lot.
And with the class differences, it was that...
the wealthier could afford fur-lined cloaks. Complete lining of squirrel fur was already quite expensive, mainly for the well-off. Common people used fur as simple inner lining, with the fur side facing inward for more warmth, but without the elaborate workmanship.
Pragmatic, basically. Main thing is staying warm.
But clothing alone isn't enough when you come home in the evening and the house is a cold stone building.
That's where a fascinating concept comes in. The wood-panelled chamber. It was literally a house within a house. They built smaller rooms of wood inside these large stone buildings. Wooden walls, wooden ceiling, a natural insulation layer.
And in this smaller space, you could retain the heat.
People in the Middle Ages were much cleverer than is often thought. There were definitely efforts to make dwellings comfortable. It wasn't a permanent ice age indoors.
The heating itself is also fascinating. The tiled stove. It existed since the early Middle Ages, but really caught on in the 12th, 13th century was, well, it was a real technical breakthrough. The efficiency compared to an open fire was enormous. We're talking 50 to 70%, depending on construction.
Compared to an open fire, where maybe only 5 to 15% reached you, the rest went straight up the flue.
The stove stored the heat and released it over hours. You fired it up once in the morning and evening and then had consistent pleasant temperatures. Radiant heat from the surface.
And they were often built as rear loaders. The fire was fed from the kitchen or hallway, but the actual stove body stood in the living chamber. A smoke-free living space.
The wood savings were considerable. A tiled stove needed maybe half as much fuel as an open fire for the same warmth.
Additionally, there were portable fire pans and charcoal braziers. You could move them around the room as needed. Flexible heat, if you will.
People really did create cozy retreats. In the panelled chamber with the tiled stove, maybe a warming stone for the bed.
You heated it up and then put it under the covers. A medieval hot water bottle.
The image of constantly freezing people in the Middle Ages is simply too one-sided. They developed impressive solutions with the means they had. Warmly dressed and in the cozy chamber, that was half the battle. But without provisions, you still wouldn't have survived the winter.
Food storage was existential. No supermarkets, no refrigerators. Everything had to be stored before the first frost.
And that required real know-how. The preservation methods were varied. Meat was cured, meaning preserved in salt. Or smoked. We still know that today from ham and bacon. Or preserved in fat, which essentially seals it airtight.
Lard on top, and it keeps for months. With fruit, they dried it. Apples, pears, plums, cut into slices and air-dried or kiln-dried. Or they made fruit butter from it.
And then the famous sauerkraut. Cabbage was fermented, a fermentation process. The genius of it, it not only kept forever, but also provided, in the depths of winter,
vitamins. That was really important for winter nutrition. Together with other winter vegetables, it helped people stay healthy through winter.
Root vegetables like turnips were stored in sand. The sand layer regulated moisture and prevented rot. Grain, legumes, and nuts then formed the basis of the diet.
Towns and monasteries stockpiled huge supplies. It was well organized. They knew if things run short in February, there'll be unrest.
In the countryside, people were more on their own. No central supply. What you didn't store in autumn,
you didn't have in January, period.
And then there was still the question.
Exactly, the question of firewood. That was at least as critical as food.
Firewood was a precious commodity, essential for survival and correspondingly expensive. We're talking about, well, I need to approach this differently. A small, modest household might get by with 3 to 7 cubic meters per winter. But larger houses, or those with open hearths, needed considerably more. And with hundreds or thousands of households in a city,
that's enormous quantities.
In cities, anyway. The costs could consume a considerable portion of income. In bad years, even more.
Oh, heating is a luxury. That's so easy to forget today.
The logistics behind it were massive. Wood was felled in the forests, often in winter itself, because the roads were frozen and passable then. Then it was bound into rafts and transported over the rivers, sometimes over great distances.
And these rafters, they steered it?
With long oars and poles. They had to know every section of the river, shallows, weirs, mill dams. At the destination, the rafts were dismantled and the wood was sold at municipal timber yards.
Cities were especially dependent on this. They didn't have their own forests right at their doorstep. In the countryside, you could at least go into the forest yourself.
The social differences were especially visible here. Those with money bought good hardwood, oak, beech. That burns long and hot.
And those without money?
The poorer population depended on collecting brushwood and fallen branches, searching the forest for fallen limbs, gathering twigs. That burns up quickly and gives far less heat.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
That means the poor froze, even with a fire, more than the rich. The gap was real.
Some sat in warm rooms with glowing tile stoves. Others fought the cold with a pile of brushwood. But, and this is important, people also helped each other. Monasteries distributed firewood to the needy in times of hardship.
The harsh conditions brought people together. They depended on each other. And this community was also celebrated.
Winter wasn't just a struggle for survival. There were bright spots too.
The long winter evenings. Imagine that. From 4, half past 4 in the afternoon, it was dark. And then another 10, 12 hours until dawn.
Without electric light, a real challenge.
Light sources were correspondingly important. The best were beeswax candles. Bright, steady light, hardly any smell. But that was pure luxury. They were mainly used in churches or in very wealthy households.
And for ordinary people?
Tallow candles. They were made from animal fats, usually beef or mutton tallow.
much more affordable, but, well, the smell. In a closed room?
It must have been pretty pungent.
Rancid fat burning, plus the soot. The air in such a room in winter was certainly not what we'd call cozy today. But you get used to a lot.
And for those who couldn't even afford tallow candles?
Pine splinters. These are resin-soaked pieces of wood, usually from pine trees. They were clamped in holders and lit. Burn quickly, flicker badly, produce enormous soot, but they cost almost nothing.
The social hierarchy was reflected even in light.
And when you then lay in bed at night?
Of course, the warming stone came into play again, which we briefly mentioned earlier.
A really simple but effective method, which we already mentioned briefly.
That must have made the cold nights quite a bit more bearable.
Together with the fire pans that you could also move around the room, there were definitely ways to make things bearable. But sure, getting up in the morning in the cold room was still no pleasure.
What did a workday in winter actually look like?
Shorter. Much shorter. The days only had 8-9 hours of daylight. Working outdoors was limited, and artificial lighting for fine work was expensive.
In the cities, that must have been problematic.
Absolutely. Construction projects mostly stopped completely in winter. Day laborers found no employment. Seasonal unemployment was a real problem, without a social safety net.
And in the countryside?
There, winter was more of a different kind of work. Farmers used the time for repairs, fixing tools, making new equipment, chests, furniture, everything they hadn't managed in summer. Processing raw materials like flax or wool also fell into these months.
So no break, just different activities.
And then there was the putting out system. That's, how do I best explain it? Imagine a merchant in town gives a weaver in the countryside the wool. The weaver works at home, produces fabric, and the merchant picks up the finished product.
Like home working. The client provides material, the worker delivers results.
In principle, yes. The craftsmen were provided with raw materials and worked in their own homes. Tailors made clothing, weavers processed the yarn spun in summer.
An early precursor of outsourcing.
It offered opportunities, additional income, especially for farming families, but it also carried risks. Dependence on the client, prices were dictated, the danger of exploitation was real.
So economically, winter was a dry spell for many. But not just stand still. People adapted, found niches, worked differently. Despite all the hardships, winter also had its beautiful sides. Festivals and celebrations structured the dark season.
Christmas, of course, then Epiphany, Candlemas in early February, and finally Shrovetide as the grand finale before Lent. These festivals gave winter a rhythm.
Communal meals, processions, games, that strengthened the bonds within the community. People celebrated together, drank from cups and tankards made of wood, clay or pewter.
And there were customs that still exist today. The Perchten procession, for example. Winter demons were driven out with masks and noise. That's still known in the Alpine region today.
And then the amusements. Sleigh riding, snowboard fights.
Ice skating on frozen lakes and rivers. That's well documented in contemporary illustrations.
The ice skates back then were made of animal bones, by the way. Horse or cattle bones that you tied under your shoes.
Made of bones?
The underside was polished smooth. It glided surprisingly well over the ice. Later came wooden runners with iron fittings.
And sledding. Imagine, sliding down the hill on animal hides.
Or on simple wooden boards. People made do with what they had. The principle is the same as today, just more rustic.
In the cities, bathhouses were also important meeting places. It wasn't just about washing. It was a social place. People met, chatted, warmed up.
If we now look back at everything that we...
If we sum all that up, a clear picture emerges.
Winter in the Middle Ages was... Yes, it was a real challenge. Cold periods, scarce supplies, expensive warmth. But people didn't just survive. They adapted, found solutions, cultivated community.
They preserved moments of comfort and joy, despite everything. And that deserves respect.
The strategies they developed, from the layering principle and clothing to food preservation, these are achievements that can still inspire us today.
Much of it has survived. Christmas traditions, carnival, even sauerkraut is winter food. The connection to that time is closer than we often think.
And with that, we've reached the end of our journey through the medieval winter.
That was fun. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
If you want to learn more about topics like this, at battlemerchant.com/blog, you'll find many more fascinating articles for history enthusiasts. And of course, an extensive range of medieval clothing and equipment.
Feel free to visit. Until next time.
Take care and stay warm.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.